Well, if we're involved in God's work, we can expect opposition. I'm not saying it happens. I'm not even saying it usually happens. I'm saying it's to be expected. And opposition, though it's worth checking, doesn't mean we've gone wrong in our walk with Jesus. That's what Jesus teaches us. He says, if the world hates you, keep in mind it hated me first. The idea that we can be involved in Christian ministry and not have enemies is a much cherished illusion. And any of the brothers and sisters in the persecuted church we pray for regularly will remind us of that. It's a much cherished illusion fueled by a sense of love and niceness we feel should surround the Christian and the passionate desire of most of us to be liked. But it is fantasy. And Jesus sets our expectations straight. He says many disturbing lines, doesn't he? I think one of the most disturbing is this. Woe to you when all men speak well of you. He puts it the other way around as well. He says, no servant is greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also. If we take Christian commitment, Christian ministry, Christian discipleship seriously, we must be ready for opposition and enemies. Not go looking for them, not pride ourselves on having made them, but expect them. And behind the enemies, the human faces of the opposition, of course, lies the enemy, Satan himself. Now, as we pick up these memoirs of a senior civil servant from way back, we'll find Nehemiah's history makes the same point very clearly. If you were with us last week, you'll remember Jerusalem lies defenseless, its walls in ruins, and as Nehemiah comes to rebuild the people of God, whichever way they look, they find an enemy face staring back at them. They've got names attached. You see at the beginning of chapter 4 in verse 1, there's the first of them, Sanballat, a Babylonian name. He was governor of Samaria. He was to the north. And then in verse 3, there's Tobiah, a Hebrew name. In fact, he seems to have many relatives in the city. That's why they can never quite shrug him off. He was a ruler of Ammonite territory. He was to the east. And by chapter 6, we're told of another, Geshem, an Arab, chief of the desert tribes of North Arabia, and he would have been to the south. And to the west, there's another enemy, the sea. Now, of course, here at All Souls, we've got walls and doors, and they seem to work well enough, but we're building a church, and we're surrounded by all kinds of opposing beliefs too. Not just secular society that imagines you can face the religious distortions of our day with a spiritual vacuum. But as the ministry team pointed out to me, to the south we've got the materialism of Oxford Street, the sex trade of Soho. To the north and the east, the liberal humanism of so many media outlets. To the west, well, there's Islam and all kinds of faith positions at Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park. There's the Jehovah's Witnesses at Oxford Circus. That's at the church family level. At the personal level, I don't know what ministry God has called you to, what ministry God has given you. There'll be mums and dads here with children to invest in and build up. There'll be some looking in the opposite direction to elderly parents who need caring and supporting. All of us, I imagine, will have neighbours, colleagues, friends. God has put you alongside to point to faith or to encourage in their faith. Some have a fellowship group to lead. Others a Christianity Explored table to help at. And Nehemiah reminded us that his job and his work skills were how he served God too. It would be a big surprise to me if the voices we hear this morning from Nehemiah's day, however dated, aren't among the voices real or imagined that stop our ministries or distract us from them. So come and explore them together. Have a look at what I've called the enemy tactics. It's not always as straightforward as we imagine. If he doesn't have the better arguments, he can do fine without them. See, he's at ease in a post-truth society. In fact, he invented a post-truth society. He knows how to play to the populism. He knows how to tug at emotions. Well, look how he begins. Ridicule. Chapter 4. See, watch Sanballat's progression in verse 1. As he hears the wall is being rebuilt, he's angry. He's greatly incensed. He ridiculed. The Good News Bible captures the spirit of what he says. What do these miserable Jews think they're doing? Do they intend to rebuild the city? Do they think that by offering sacrifices, they can finish the work in one day? Can they make building stones out of burnt rubble? I mean, they're the sort of questions that make bullies laugh together. The sort of mockery that has a demoralizing sting to it. I mean, look how they carry on in verse 3. What they're building, even a fox climbing up on it would break down their wall of stones. It's not going to be much of a wall, is it? Actually, archaeology suggests that Nehemiah's walls were several feet thick. Would have been some fox. But then you see, laughter is such a dangerous weapon because it doesn't need truth or facts. It bites very deep. It can disguise its own lack of substance. You know how it is, don't you? Know one cutting aside. What a complete waste of time. It can be far more damaging than an 8-point rebuttal. Ridicule. And then there's threat. In verses 6 to 12, the walls are going up and the enemies were very angry, verse 7, and they all plotted together, verse 8, and as the work got harder, verse 10, the enemy puts the boot in. He's good at that kind of timing. So verse 11, also our enemies said, before they know it or see us, we'll be right there among them and we'll kill them and put an end to the work. And they don't actually have to do any of it. They don't need to, just threaten it. See the response, verse 12? Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, wherever you turn, they'll attack us. But that's how it works when fear grips. It grows itself. Rumor leads to paranoia, leads to defeatism. It's why we keep our heads below the parapet in a hostile culture, isn't it? We don't talk of Jesus and his values, often because of what we fear might happen, not because of what has happened. Ridicule, threat. But actually, even success brings its perils as well. If you turn over the page to chapter 6, the walls may be gateless, but it is rebuilt, so the enemies try a compromise. Verse 2, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message. Come, let's meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. But they were scheming to harm me. All the same, it seems such a reasonable suggestion, doesn't it? Such a Christian request. Let's talk. I mean, what's wrong with that? There's so much hostility and competitiveness and division already in the world. What's the problem in talking? And you know, when that idea floats around, sooner or later, someone is going to come up with that old maxim of jaw, jaw is better than war, war. But sometimes, there is nothing to talk about. No negotiating to be done. No further shared conversations to be involved in. There is a time when the only question is, will I obey God's call or not? Oh, and then there was slander. They talk about an unsealed letter. I think that was a kind of ancient equivalent of an internet blog. You know, it was rubbish. It was distorted. It was personal and dangerous. It played on Jerusalem's history of being a city of rebellion. And verse 6, it says of Nehemiah, you're about to become their king. You say anything emphatically enough and it sounds true. You know, it's reported among the nations, and Geshem says it's true. So it sounds all the more threatening. Lots of others think that as well. Sometimes when people talk about lots of others, it's worth getting the actual names. I remember one parish I was in, four or five people used to meet every Sunday evening after the evening service and have a cup of coffee in one of their homes and share their grumbles together. And then we'd be told how lots of people are saying this. It was always the same four or five. It was really just one voice. Now, verse 7, this report will get back to the king. Well, of course it will, because they've posted it. But when your motives are twisted, when a lie and a distortion's used to malign and intimidate you, it hurts. It gets under the skin. It can affect your wife, your husband, even more. You know, one of the worst I had was when a travesty account of a pastoral situation became a slander passed around at the school gates. I wasn't totally naive. I expected opposition. What I learned then was, yes, expect opposition and don't expect the opposition to play fair. So they move from slander to intimidation in verses 10 to 13. And it's the insider picking up on the threats and urging Nehemiah to hide in the temple for his own safety. And he says, verse 11, should a man like me run away? God called me to build the wall, not to hide in the temple. I will not go. And I realized God had not sent him. He'd been hired to intimidate me. But your defenses often come down when it's the insider speaking. Though it can actually just be the devil playing all his usual tricks. You know, from the parishioner who made a pass at me, not at All Souls, I hasten to add, to the cathedral service reading from the Quran. If this range of enemy tactics doesn't ring any bells with you at all, I probably ought to ask, are you sure you're in the battle? Vijay Menon, some of you will know him, the converted Hindu, once sent me a birthday card and he scribbled inside it a message full of his typical humour. It just ran, "Happy birthday, Hugh. May you have many more years to suffer for the gospel." But he said that the enemy tactic hasn't changed anything to mess up God's work. Only we've got to learn not to change course because we're tired of being the object of his attacks. These last two or three months at All Souls have been some of the most bruising I can remember. All kinds of attacks and distractions and painful issues have come up to handle. And when you're caught up in many of them, it can be very draining. And yet at the same time, they've been full of opportunities. From Christmas, what's happening with the youth looking at Life Explored on Friday evenings here, to a striking series of guest events. Springboard's had to put on a new table. They've got too many people coming to it. There are about 150 students going on that weekend away, and they're still full of the serious encouragements of their mission week here. I heard a wonderful tribute the other day to the love and support of a fellowship group in time of real need. See, hurts and pressures, bruises and stresses, they're real and they're painful and they're normal. But God's church is still being built. So how are we meant to respond to an enemy trying all these schemes and tricks? You know, do you just suck it up, as a friend of mine says? There are times when you have to. But come back again and look through these chapters and see Nehemiah's response. And as you read through the chapters, you certainly sense Nehemiah feels the loneliness of leadership. People don't usually just laugh off opposition. And the pressure and the weight falls on his shoulders. Mark Dever, the American pastor, wrote, "Facing opposition well is usually more complicated than it looks, but that's what a leader does." Only you don't have to be a leader to learn from Nehemiah. Just watch him. See, his dependence on God. Someone once said, don't let opposition drive you from God. Make sure it drives you to God. Which sounds pretty obvious, doesn't it? But I remember the first time I came across that, I realized that's exactly what I've been allowing opposition to do. You know, I'd got half my brain trying to handle the emotional turmoil that came with it all, and the other half of my brain trying to analyze the opposition and what we might do about it, and there was absolutely nothing left to leave room for God himself. Only Nehemiah doesn't make that mistake. His prayers, his speech, his thinking, they're shaped by God. He encourages the people with God. He doesn't go around saying, cheer up, and I'm sure we can sort something. See, come back to chapter 4 and have a look at verse 9. We prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet his threat. Or verse 14. Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome. Or verse 20, our God will fight for us. See, it's the Lord's strength, not Nehemiah's rhetoric, that'll put iron into the soul of his people. And he prays too. He prays against people. Look at verse 4 of chapter 4. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Do not cover up their guilt. By chapter 6, he's praying, remember Tobiah and Sanballat, my God, because of what they've done. It's not a suggestion for the next honors list. He wants them in the hall of shame, not the hall of fame. And writers are torn. Is this sort of petty vengefulness? Or is it seeing attacks on God's people as an attack on God himself and longing for God to vindicate himself and the world to see he is God? Well, however God deals with Nehemiah's requests, I think the prayers give a clue to the emotional energy price paid in facing opposition. But they're also a reminder that it's a dangerous thing to stand against God's people. Don't find yourself there. It's dependent on God, and yet also he takes practical precautions. I mention it because Nehemiah is not naively super spiritual. You know, we've prayed about it, full stop. But sometimes all you can do is pray about it, but not always. And you see, back in verse 9 of chapter 4, we prayed to God and posted a guard. It sums him up. Trust God and keep your powder dry, Cromwell said. And Nehemiah is not slow to take practical steps. He posts people around the wall in families because you'll fight better to protect your own. He keeps the trumpeter close to him because the trumpeter's the communication system. His spirituality combines prayer and action. Not everyone's does. I remember reading an obscure footnote once that explained there was a split in the Uganda revival of the 1960s. One group, the Kufu Fuka, they said, you're not Christian if you protected your property. Trust the Lord, not dogs, was their slogan. Didn't seem to occur to them what the other group thought, that God might answer their prayer through the dogs. I think Nehemiah would have probably been with them. And it's not just practicalities. He led by example. His godly lifestyle is very striking. You know, were long hours and guard duty going to be needed to build the wall? Well, Nehemiah did his share. Look at the end of chapter 4, verse 23. Neither I, nor my brothers, nor my men, nor the guards with me took off our clothes. You think the laundrette's going to be needed at the end of it, don't you? Each had his weapon, even when he went for water. Yeah, he's just like everyone around. And that's just a start. If you read chapter 5, you'll find an extraordinary exploitation and division within the people of Israel. See, the people are under pressure. They've got the same number of mouths to feed, the same amount of taxes to pay to their rulers, and with all the building work going on, less time to work their fields. But you know, every cloud has a silver lining for someone. And the wealthy provide grain for them and loans, and then rake in the profits on the interest, repossess the fields, reintroduce slavery. It is almost unbelievable. And internal splits are so much more painful than external opposition. And Nehemiah faces the loan sharks down, calls them out, stops it, and some. You discover for 12 years as governor, he didn't take the food offered to the governor or the silver his predecessors had taken as a tax. He worked and didn't even acquire land for himself. So you turn the page, you come to the end of chapter 5, and you read in verse 17, "Furthermore, 150 Jews and officials ate at my table, as well as those who came to us from the surrounding nations." He was growing an international community. "And each day, one ox, six choice sheep, and some poultry were prepared for me, and every 10 days an abundant supply of wine of all kinds. In spite of this, I never demanded the food allotted to the governor, because the demands were heavy on the people." Nehemiah may have been wealthy, but this must have been very costly. But then, you follow a leader who'll put his money where his mouth is, don't you? And it's not that Nehemiah has a soft touch or reduces discipleship to being nice. I'm also struck by his straight talking. Not just to the fat cats within Israel, but to the enemies without. I mean, look ahead to chapter 6 and verse 3. They want him to stop building and come to peace talks. And he replies, "I'm carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you?" People say, come to peace talks. And I keep stepping into their shoes. I try to see both sides of the argument. He's clear. He's involved in a gospel work. He's not going to be distracted. And he does it again in verse 8 when they accuse him of setting himself up to be king. He just says, "Nothing like what you are saying is happening. You're just making it up." It does save an awful lot of time, doesn't it? We just give the straight answer, that's it, finished. Because there is a time when it's not Christian just to be nice. When God's priorities need to be faced. His people are vulnerable. The lost are perishing. And Nehemiah's not going to let go of those priorities. He's not going to be talked out of them either. And underlying it all, whatever's thrown at him, you can't miss his persistence. Nehemiah won't be distracted. The man who left the Persian court to work on the disgrace, the wall of Jerusalem, who spent a fortune doing God's will and faced opposition and ridicule and threat. There's a pattern you'll see even more vividly in Jesus himself. And it's echoed in normal Christian ministry. Nehemiah won't be distracted. William Carey, the great missionary, actually a very gifted man, once said rather self-deprecatingly, he said, "I can plod." It's always stuck with me, that. It's such an encouraging thing. You know, on the days when you feel you're up to nothing, "I can plod." Nehemiah could plod. And you read verse 15 of chapter 6. "So the wall was completed in 52 days. Nehemiah can plod quickly." And the next verse, "When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence, while Nehemiah and the people kept their God confidence." The nations lost their self-confidence because they realized this work had been done with the help of our God. Now, the opposition didn't stop at the end of chapter 6. It makes it clear. Nehemiah keeps our feet on the ground. He's not the only one who can be persistent, but there's only going to be one winner. I remember a while ago, asking a wise old minister friend once. I said to him, what do you look for in a disciple these days? I didn't really know what he was going to say back, but I certainly didn't expect this. He didn't use a Bible term at all. He just said stickability. Stickability. He said, there are loads of people with a where I'll help when I can and when it suits mindset. I'm looking for people who can handle the disappointments, plod in spite of the knocks. The last few months at All Souls may have been unusual in their intensity, but the pattern of knocks and opportunities are normal. Stickability is what we need as a church. And stickability is what you'll need for whatever ministries God has given to you. And stickability, though the word doesn't appear, is at the heart of our last hymn. It begins with a great confident commitment to stickability. Oh, Jesus, I've promised to serve you to the end. And then very wisely rushes to dependent prayer. I shall not fear the battle if you are by my side, nor wander from the pathway if you will be my guide.